It's always competing with liposuction. They always kind of go back and forth.
Kind of like the Bears and the Packers, right?
No, no, that's Bears are always kind of. Oh. They're sisters, not twins. Yeah. I messed it up now. I got so excited.
Just tossed up that softball, man, to you.
I know, I know. You had mentioned something about Frankenstein and breast implants. What was that all about?
So, Frankenboob is a common term used.
Welcome to Fuller Butts, a behind-the-scenes plastic surgery podcast. Yes, you heard that right. Join your co-hosts, Dr. Sam Fuller and Dr. Dan Butts, board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeons, on an exclusive full-access pass into the world of plastic surgery. Combining their expertise and training, Drs. Fuller and Butts will share medical insights, detailed explanations, and lighthearted humor to keep you entertained and informed. We're certain you'll become passionate about the plastic surgery specialty, and between debunking myths, uncovering truths, or just making you laugh out loud at their perspective on this creative and artistic field, we've got something for everyone. From tummy tucks to Botox and mommy makeovers to surgery do-overs, the Fuller Butts podcast will surely satisfy your podcast fix. All right, now let's dive into this episode.
All right. Welcome back to Fuller Butts Behind the Scenes Look at Plastic Surgery. I'm Dr. Daniel Butts, and with me today here is Dr. Fuller. How are you doing today?
Dr. Sam Fuller here, loud and proud. Happy to give it 100% here. We're just going to totally crush this one, I feel.
Yeah. Episode number two, just getting into obviously one of the most popular procedures in plastic surgery, which is
breast augmentation. Did it take over as number one over liposuction?
It's always competing with liposuction. They always kind of go back and forth.
Kind of like the Bears and the Packers, right?
No, no, that's Bears are always kind of. Oh.
It's kind of like the Packers and the Niners, or is that too soon? Should I not bring that
too
up?
Soon? Too soon. They've been dominating us lately.
So I was,
let's move away from sport, Rick.
I was with you for your birthday, and I was rooting for the Packers. Let it be known, I was one of the loudest cheerers of the Packers, besides your other buddy.
Yes, ortho bro.
Yes,
yeah, that was fun. But yeah, breast augmentation every year there's probably over 300,000 performed. There was a little bit of a spike during COVID years, and it's kind of gone back down to a little bit lower again. But yeah, I think liposuction, you know, I don't think those stats probably capture a lot of the in-office liposuction that's done, especially, unfortunately, by a lot of the non-board certified plastic surgeons. So that probably does dominate in the grand scheme of things. But that's a different story.
Did you see a spike in COVID, like during COVID or immediately after COVID when things were lifted? Like, what numbers are you?
I mean, just nationally, I think, you know, this is what the reps told me and what the numbers kind of showed is, you know, not the 6 week COVID kind of pause. Obviously a lot of surgery centers were shut down for that. But those, you know, 2 years, 3 years since, there was definitely a big uptick. I think it was likely, you know, people weren't spending money on a lot of the other things they used to spend money on, traveling, going out to dinner, and had more time to kind of recover in hiding, during, you know, quarantining and whatnot. So it was kind of a convenient time for plastic surgery, and there's extra money sitting around for a lot of people too.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge spike in just facial rejuvenation, like tox fillers, because everyone was on these sorts of calls
Zooms,
and
totally
looking at their face and the wrinkles and stuff. And so, we see that as well. And I think things have kind of normalized even in the last 6 to 8 months now, several years afterwards, where we're kind of just seeing what the normal frequency of breast augmentation is, but there's always going to be ups and downs just with social media, with what pop culture pushes patients to do. And I think we're going to have a podcast coming up soon about just trends that we love and trends that we hate within plastic surgery. But today's topic, breast augmentation.
So tell me, how do you go about your consultation process with a patient when they come in and say they want a breast augmentation? Everyone probably does it differently. There's a lot of ways to do the surgery itself, but how do you do the consult?
Yeah. So, how I approach the consultation, as in most, is, just try to familiarize the patient with myself. I'll give a little bit of background, just try to break the ice, just talk a little bit about what my goals are for plastic surgery, which is enhancing patients to look natural, to feel, positive in their image of themselves, self-confidence, self-care, and really let them direct what bothers them, in the conversation. So it's always helpful if they have pictures of what they used to look like or want to look like, just as an idea or an example. But I always caution them that each person is uniquely different as far as their body. Even someone with the same height and weight, they may carry it differently. It's always ideal to know what their bra size is and what their goal bra size should be or could be for them. I have this finding, and I'm not sure, I'm just going to ask you because I haven't asked you before, but a huge percent of patients just don't know what their bra size is. Do you have that as well?
Yeah, I think, and that's inherently a problem after surgery as well. And in terms of trying to determine what that goal size is, it's oftentimes people aren't sized properly. They haven't been sized in a long time. Weight's changed. They lost breast. You know, all these things take place, and they just don't really know, or are wearing kind of more bralettes, sports bras most of the time. So I think that is very common. I ask those questions, but I tell everyone I'm less concerned what the letter is at the end of the day in the bra and more concerned that it fits their frame and achieves their goals, whether that, that could be anywhere. I have some patients that looks like a B cup, but they're wearing a D cup, and it just comes down to oftentimes bandwidth and company that they're buying from, not so much that they're, a lot of people think a D cup's going to look big and fake, and that's not really true at all.
Yeah, I think that that is some of the problem or some of the confusion is that they may not be properly sized to begin with. So their goal size is also improper. And so I'm always telling the patient that, my goal is to fit their body, and, it's really based on measurements. And then it also has to do with some artistic appreciation. Then ultimately what the patient wants, has to be a part of that decision. And that triangular data mining is really what brings to be the overall result. I always tell the patients that, up to one out of three women, if they had to do it over again, would choose a slightly larger implant. And so some of those outgoing polls or statistics to me are important just to mention to the patient. I'm certainly not trying to upsize. I, personally, am not interested in huge, large breasts. My goal is for them to be fuller and then just to look nice and natural for that. So, with that, I never promise a bra size, just as you mentioned, depending on what store you go to, they have different C's and D's and all of that. So basically, we just want to look much better, more refreshed. And so I'll actually measure them. I write the numbers down and then I'll step out and I have a sizing kit that I'll have them put on a bra, or we provide them with the bra. And then I have these sizers or cutlets that go over the skin, under the bra, in a range of sizes. And I tell them that there are sizes in between these, but this just gives me a ballpark as to what they're envisioning their breast to look like. And then oftentimes they ask me, well, you just measured it. What size would you think I should be? And I'm always like, I want this to be a double-blinded study. I'm not going to give away what my sizing measurements are. I want you really to see for yourself and let me use that number so that it's a useful tool. And I would say most of the time, the numbers are pretty close. There's a few who either are interested in a size that's too large for them. It's going to look like the implant's fallen into the breast or into the armpit, or it's going to make them look overweight or heavy, or there's one that's just not even going to fill out the breast footprint. So there's a little bit of back and forth. I always have at least two visits with the patient before I decide on a breast implant size. What's your philosophy for that?
Yeah, it's some similarities for sure. When I first started, I used to spend 20-25 minutes at the beginning of the consult kind of like diving into a lot of the like nitty-gritty details of the surgery, the recovery, breast implant illness, not being a lifetime device. At some point, like we need, breast implant associated amplistic large cell lymphoma, like kind of all this stuff that I thought was really important to be aware of. It was also kind of overwhelming. For two reasons. I wanted the patients to come and kind of come in a little bit more prepared and not being overwhelmed. So I've made a video of all this information that it's a little bit like homework, I suppose. We don't, if they don't do it, we just go over it and send it to them later. But just so they can see how I approach things.
Or do they score well on the homework assignment?
There's no test. But oftentimes they come in with questions from it, which is the goal. They kind of, again, understand how I approach things, kind of get some foundational information about the surgery itself, the recovery, incision placement, pros and cons above the role of the muscle. That's really helped patients, I think, just understand, again, my philosophy and how I do the surgery, no touch technique, really trying to, optimize, long-term results. But then, talking about what their bra size is or where they're roughly at, what changes, if they've breastfed, what changes they have had, any weight fluctuations, what their kind of goals are. Wish pics, I'm not I think they're useful if someone's like really having a hard time describing what they're looking for, but they're also so limited because everyone's anatomy is so different. But they can kind of give you a sense of if they want it a little bit fuller, a little bit more natural. What some people think is natural, I might think looks a little bit more enhanced.
I mean, it's just it's a stepping point. It's a data point. And oftentimes I use that picture just to reiterate the point that everybody's body is different. And, you know, quite honestly, like, hey, this patient is probably 4 or 5 inches taller than you, or, you know, their shoulders are much narrower, and just kind of point out the differences just because the patient may not see that. And then it's always important to let the patient know that oftentimes the breasts are different in themselves. And so trying to point out, hey, this left nipple sits a little bit lower, the right side's larger, and talking about different implant sizes. I know that we were both trained similarly, so we'd probably say the same mantra. And one of the best lines that we say is,
"They're sisters, not twins." I messed it up now. I got so excited.
Just tossed up that softball, man, to
you. I know.
So they're sisters, not twins. And so I think that's important. And it, you know, does bring a little bit of humor into the conversation.
And a lot of people then tell me, oh, that's what my brow person tells me about my eyebrows. So, you know, our bodies are asymmetric in a lot of different ways. Face asymmetry, you know, you see those split face pictures and they make it perfectly symmetrical. It looks weird.
I actually use it in the hand world too. So for my hands, they always say, like, why does my left thumb hurt? My right doesn't. And I say, hey, your hands are siblings, not twins. And they just beat it up. So I definitely still that from the plastic surgery world. I mean, the breast augmentation consultation, it's good to be thorough. You know, I always just try to educate the patients, but briefly, you know, tell them that they should be going to a board certified plastic surgeon. They should have access to before and after pictures. It's important to talk about sizing or what their goals are, but, you know, start with a clean slate as far as basing it on their anatomy, their measurements. How do you size them up, or how do you pick the right size?
Yeah. So it's sizing. I kind of use a 3-step process, again, similar to yours with one additional thing. First we take measurements. So, you know, look at their anatomy. I often will point out little differences in nipple position, or oftentimes the rib cages are a little different projection on one side versus the other. Breast volume can be, you know, different as well. Not to make them feel bad about it, obviously, but just to be aware that just an implant's not necessarily going to change some of those variables. Sometimes we do use different size implants to try to balance those things off. Sometimes that's not always, you know, adequate to make it perfect. And then we use this little 3D simulation to take a scan, and then we try on sizers like you were discussing. So the same thing with bra, kind of sizers. I don't like using the actual implants. I think that tends to overproject and make them look a lot bigger than they're going to be. So the sizing cutlets, or, you know, companies make different ones, kind of show how the volume is dispersed a little bit better once it's underneath the skin, you know, subfascial or submuscular.
Do you have a preference on where you put the implant?
I typically go submuscular, or kind of a dual plane.
Do you change the implant sizing at all if you're going to go subglandular versus submuscular?
Not typically, but I think it's subfascial is probably going to be best and or look more natural if you're in a moderate or low plus profile. If you get to the high profile, and it's going to look fuller, more enhanced. And some patients want that, and that's totally fine. And so just trying to, again, educate and kind of discuss kind of what those differences will, you know, how that'll change the outcome. But then I often start on the, I'll start with everyone at 150 sizers and slowly kind of work our way up. Now, I like to get to a size that they feel is too big, because oftentimes they'll put on a 200, 250. Oh, this is great. And yeah, it's a big change. But if we just stop there and they didn't try the 300 or 350.
So are you in the room with them going up 50 cc's and just putting it in there and saying, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about this?
Yep. Myself and my assistant, we just kind of, you know, walk through it until we get to a size that they're like, oh, this is too much. And we go back down. And then we talk about, you know, maybe going up a little bit, because like you said, most people wish they'd gone a little bit bigger, but not. We're not trying to necessarily go, we don't want to be too big either. It's trying to explain those differences and looking at, and then talking about showing them the different profiles and why I would choose what profile for them, the different gel consistencies or how cohesive they are. So it's a pretty comprehensive, you know, process. And then I punch it into the 3D simulation. They can see it. I often show them a few different sizes on that. They can look at it at home. I use the Crystalic software, which is just on an iPad, and they can have a web-based portal that the patient can see. Which is a good tool. It's not perfect, but it's a nice adjunct.
Once I get pretty close on the sizing, what I found is helpful is just actually showing them the sizing, you know, the order sheet, and just kind of going through what a moderate plus, for instance, looks like. Because if I'm measuring their base width to be a certain diameter and they are reluctant to go up, And I'm showing, you know, trying to, you know, emphasize that this is just filling out the breast naturally, that we're not trying to project or get them larger, but we're just trying to make them complete. I find it super helpful to show that, hey, if you go from a 315 to a 365, you are moving 3 millimeters in the width direction and 2 millimeters in the projection direction. And just to show them how minuscule that is, I think it really comforts them to know that they're not, you know, getting these massive upgrades when we're just trying to balance things out and make it fit
right
in each pocket.
Yeah. So I often will show them my little cheat sheet and kind of how I choose, you know, why I'm choosing what. And then like yourself, you know, we always have a pre-op appointment about a month beforehand to review things in detail, go over sizing again, and we kind of confirm that size at that appointment. And they can always change their mind, you know, if they think about it some more, but normally it's not drastic changes.
That second appointment, you know, in my first consult note, I'll put in a range that we discussed, and then we usually narrow it down at that pre-op visit when we're discussing aftercare and recovery and going in more detail about the day of surgery and the days leading up to surgery and so forth. And so, I think we're pretty similar in planning. At the visit, I always talk about incision, what incision you make, what type of implants, saline versus gel. And then I think we're both similar. We both prefer the inframammary fold, which has lowest complication rate as far as infections, cups, or contractures. I also, similar to you, tend to go in the submuscular plane, which also has great evidence in the literature of being a safe position. I like the fact of having the muscle between the implant and the breast tissue and the cholangeal tissue, which has ducts, which has exposure and contact with the outside world. I think that that's real as far as creating capsular contracture and issues. I like the idea that the submuscular position, and this is a lot of conversations that we've had together, I think it creates a nice natural slope, a nice teardrop shape to the breast and the upper pole rather than the subglandular or even the subfascial when they're showing them, even at the national meetings that you and I attended. You can definitely see the implant and where it slopes. And oftentimes, if you're going to go subglandular or subfascial, then you're adding fat grafting and it just kind of sometimes overcomplicates or just adds unnecessary cost to that. So I think submuscular, I have not had a lot of patients with animation problems at all. And I know that that's a reason to do that. Do you find yourself consulting or consoling patients with a lot of animation issues after a submuscular breast augmentation?
No. I prepare everyone that there's going to be some animation, and there is some if it's above the muscle as well and subfascial, subglandular. And I think, you know, surgeons are definitely striving to stay subfascial because of the capsular contraction risk. Not everyone's fascia is all that strong. There's pros and cons to both. I tell everyone this. I mean, the pros, you know, historically with submuscular is that it's going to look more natural. It's going to have, you know, lower capsular contraction, more stable long-term because, you know, there's not just the tissue kind of supporting things down below, and easier to do mammograms. Another big thing as well. But you know, animation is definitely probably more prevalent. Again, normally it's not a big deal though. I kind of really stress, you know, pretty guided guidelines on pec muscle use in the first 3 to 6 months, and then kind of slowly working it up to minimize some of that. And there are benefits to subfascial, and then you're not disrupting that muscle at all. And some people want it to look fuller. You can definitely enhance the cleavage better because you're not, you know, limited by the muscle. But it tends, you're going to get more implant visibility long-term. If you lose more breast volume, it's going to be thinner. You might, you know, need more fat grafting or higher risk of, you know, an earlier revision.
And what do you think about bottoming out, like the implant falling?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the revision I've seen for subglandular are either contracted because they get a higher rate of that, or they're kind of really bottomed out because there's, you know, a lot of weight just on the skin. And, you know, with newer technology, with new internal bra meshes, I think that is a place where that's a really big benefit to support that. And I think the data is probably not, we don't have, you know, long-term results kind of showing how that's holding up, but definitely makes sense that it should help support that. And I think choosing more appropriately sized implants, I mean, sometimes people, you know, 600cc implants, subglandular, it's just a lot of gravity pulling on that tissue. So being more modest with the implant size and those placements are going to look more natural, more stable and all that. So it's not, you know, probably 90% submuscular, but there are certain patients where they're really into fitness, don't want to disrupt that muscle, don't want to have that potential or, you know, have to be having to kind of take a break from the gym as long. There are benefits to it, but I think the vast majority of my patients, benefits of submuscular outweigh the subfascial.
So yeah, you brought up a few points, and I think, you know, as we're going to wrap up, we should hit some of the frequently asked questions and some of those that maybe we can just bounce off of each other. So I'll start with you. You talked about capsular contractures or things that you've seen with revisions and subcolangelar. Does my breast implant have an expiration date? Do I need to change it 10 years from now?
What I tell every patient, they're not meant to be a lifelong device. All the data points we have typically are from these large FDA studies that are 10 years long. So all those numbers are at 10 years and the warranties are only for 10 years. So no, it's not a 10 year thing. If their implants are intact, which you can do an ultrasound to check or an MRI and everything looks good and you're happy, you can leave them alone. There is an expiration box on the package, but that's only for the sterilization process, not for the implant itself.
Is there a certain date that you say you have to get them changed by?
No, I mean, you know, when they're 20 years old, there's, you know, high, you should check out, you should be start checking, you know, consistently like the FDA recommends 5 years and then every, you know, 2 to 3 years with an, you know, ultrasounds are pretty easy and cheap. You know, MRIs are more reliable. You know, if they still look great at 20 years, you know, and they're still intact, I don't see why you have to change them.
I agree. And I also, when patients are there at 20 years, I say, you know, you're kind of rolling the dice each year. And I certainly, you know, if they just want to swap them out and exchange them, they're happy overall, or they say, hey, I've gained weight, or I've always wanted them to be bigger or smaller, or I have ptosis, I really encourage them to do something at that time. I think it's far more challenging to deal with a contracted or a ruptured implant where you're, you know, increasing the complications of the next case too, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think most revisions, let's say 15 years, are probably due to try to improve upon the result because your breasts have changed over the last 10 to 15 years and the implants tend to be quite stable. But whether it's skin laxity, loss of breast volume, want to be bigger, want to tighten that up, improve things, probably drive most revisions more so than a
But it's important that we're telling our younger patients that they're going to be having more breast surgeries, you know, several in their lifetime. And so I know you and I both do that, but that's important for our young listeners to know.
Yep. You had mentioned something about Frankenstein and breast implants. What was that all about?
So Frankenboob is a common term used, I would say, more in the blog posts and like the Facebook mom pages more than what I necessarily learned in training, but I've become familiar with it. And to me, it really helps to identify some changes that happen early in the post-op recovery. And I think patients really understand, because everyone knows what Frankenstein is or looks like, and they are comforted to know that things are changing and evolving after the breast augmentation. So what I usually say at that pre-op visit is that there's something called Frankenboob. When we place the implants in the OR and we're sitting them up and we're looking, they look wonderful. We're excited. Everyone's, you know, super excited for the patients. See them back at 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, which is usually my protocol. And, you know, things are swollen, the muscle's tight, and the implant looks a little bit elongated, and the implant's sitting up higher. And oftentimes, especially with the breast lift at the same time, the breast tissue is heavier, it's more swollen, it's sitting down lower. And so there's a period that is called Frankenboob that can last even up to 2 to 3 months where the implant is just settling, finding its new pocket. Usually there's some what's called drop and fluff that starts to happen, I would say somewhere as early as 3 to 4 weeks. Usually by 6 weeks, there's some settling, and I'll have patients come in at their 6 week and say, hey, the left one dropped. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then they're like, oh no, it's just like it started to settle in with the Frankenboob thing. And then the right side looks good. And I wouldn't say it happens in every case, but certainly tighter pockets. There's going to be a little bit more stretching that needs to happen over time, not immediately. And so this is just a term that comes up time and time again. And it's just helpful for patients to know about it ahead of time, in my opinion, at least in my practice. Is this a common phrase that you talk about with your patients?
Yeah, we often reference just that thing. You know, I tell them if they look great when they first see them the next day, they need to call me because something's probably wrong. Like, they often look high, square, boxy, Frankenboobs. And I often will say that because people do say it. Just to be prepared that it's a process, and it'll just trust the process. And I often show them photos, so they're pretty prepared for it.
Okay.
Cool. Well, that was a lot. We touched on a lot of potential other things to talk about, but, you know, breast augmentation is a big topic that we could go on for hours and hours, which we'll probably spend more time on it in the future. But yeah, covered a lot of the good.
Yeah.
Good consultation.
Internal bra, subfascial, tons of different topics we'll talk about at a different date. But great catching up as always with you. Dr. Buss, what do we talk about next week?
Tummy tucks, drainless tummy tucks. Is that a thing?
Drainless tummy tucks. Is that a thing? Is that the title?
Do people still use drains? That should be the question.
Some new techniques, technology, tidbits on tummy tucks. So we'll catch you guys next week. Thanks for listening. Subscribe below and see you guys on social media.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of Fuller Butts, a behind-the-scenes plastic surgery podcast. Doctors Fuller and Butts are so appreciative of your time and attention. We invite you to subscribe, share, and continue to enjoy our plastic surgery perspective. Feel free to reach out on Instagram at either SFullerSurgeryMD or at DanielButtsMD. That's Butts with a Z for comments, suggestions, and support. Remember, be artsy, stay scientific, and make life fun. We hope you'll join us again on the next episode of Fuller Butts.